Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. This morning, we'll be discussing the surge of COVID-19 cases in the state with Deputy Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan. We'll find out how you can get some money back from the state, and we'll learn about the Vermont Climate Council and their plans to reduce carbon emissions. But we start today's show getting to know Molly Gray, Vermont's Lieutenant Governor-elect. In her first political foray, she topped a strong field in the Democratic primary in August, then defeated Scott Milne, who just a few years ago came close to unseating then-incumbent Governor Peter Shumlin. Molly Gray, I want to thank you for joining us here on the Vermont Viewpoint.
Rick, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be on this morning.
And congratulations, Molly Gray. And listeners, Molly will be with us till 9:30. So if you'd like to ask her a question, give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email us at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Molly, take us back to a couple weeks ago as you were watching results of your first election. What were you experiencing as the night unfolded?
Wow, man, it's hard to think back. It feels like a long time ago, but I guess it really wasn't that long ago. And right now I'm very much focused on preparing for the office and packing up our campaign. But no, you know, it was a pretty incredible run. And I just want to thank my incredible campaign team, my campaign manager, Samantha Sheehan, who ran a campaign from her home in Hancock. Graham, who was a finance director, who grew up in Rochester, David from South Burlington. It was really special. We had a very, very small gathering just with campaign staff on election night, and just were there together, you know, watching the results come in. And, you know, I'm just filled with gratitude and recognize the incredible privilege it is to run for office in a state that you love and represent the communities that you love. And now be able to serve Vermont as lieutenant governor.
You were holding about an 8 to 10 point lead through most of the evening. At what point did you know that you were going to be Vermont's next lieutenant governor?
You know, it was when Scott Milne called, and he was very respectful and wished me the very best. And then that sort of felt like, okay, this is real, and here we go. So. We took some time to talk to the press, and then over the last couple of weeks, I spent time seeing myself, talking to my family. Haven't been able to see them, unfortunately, because of COVID. But, yeah, packing up the campaign and getting ready. And it's going to be a really interesting and different start to the legislative session. I don't know if you've talked to legislators yet, but it looks like we will be meeting via Zoom and working on COVID response largely. So I look forward to being part of that and diving right in, getting ready.
Have you ever run for anything else in your life, Molly?
I do sit on the board of the Vermont Bar Association. We had a small election, but, you know, I haven't. We were talking as a team. We're all former competitive athletes. I grew up in Orange County and spent a lot of time ski racing growing up. I ski race for the University of Vermont. I do think there's some similarities between ski racing and or athletics and campaigning, but no, I haven't run for office before.
When and why did you decide that this was your time to dive into politics?
You know, growing up here, growing up, as I said, in Orange County, going through our school system, I've had the opportunity to work in Washington for a Congressman Peter Welch and go to Vermont Law School. I've lived and worked in communities across the state, you know, in Bethel and Rutland, worked up in St. Albans one summer, serving statewide as an assistant attorney general. But one thing really started to stick out over the last few years, and it's, you know, something that a lot of, I think, statewide officials talk about, but it's our demographic challenges, the fact that we've really struggled to keep a generation here or, you know, bring a generation back or, frankly, draw a new generation to Vermont. And in Newberry, where I grew up, you know, there's more lights off than lights on. The school's shrinking, and we see this across the state. Our tax base continues to shrink. So I started thinking about it more and more and talking to friends and business owners, and finally thought, well, why don't we focus Lieutenant Governor's office on Vermont's demographic challenges? And, you know, for me, it was a really exciting and important opportunity to draw on a lifetime of experience to try to help solve this problem. You know, of course, after announcing that I was going to run in late January, COVID happened. We were pretty quickly stopped right in our tracks, but not for long. And the campaign has really been focused on, the campaign was focused on, you know, these demographic issues. You know, how do we bring a generation here to engage in remote work? You know, how do we fix our broadband gap? And how do we focus on childcare so we can keep a generation in the workforce and able to, you know, raise and support a family in Vermont? But realizing really quickly that a lot of those same issues that impact a generation that want to live and work and stay in Vermont are the same issues that have been laid bare by this pandemic. You know, a fourth of Vermont still can't get online, you know, something like 70,000 homes and residences. And as we're thinking about keeping our kids in school or moving to online learning as this pandemic picks back up, you know, there are a lot of vulnerabilities in our system that have been exposed. So we saw that during the campaign, and I think there's a lot of room to, you know, first get through this really challenging period, but then focus on recovering stronger from this pandemic and doing it in a way that sets us up for a more economically viable future.
Now, Lieutenant Governor is like the state's vice president. There's not a lot of power that comes with it. You have a list of things you'd like to accomplish there. How do you do that as the Lieutenant Governor of Vermont?
Well, first and foremost, I think it's really important to recognize that we are all custodians of an office, right? As, you know, coming in as Lieutenant Governor, the constitutional responsibilities include presiding over the Senate. Mm-hmm. And that's an extremely important role, and I don't take it lightly. So I'm spending a lot of time right now working with the Secretary of the Senate, John Bloomer, who's just such an incredible public servant and institution for Vermont, preparing to preside. And as I said, that will be via Zoom. I'll probably be down in Montpelier in the Senate chamber, working with him every day and making sure that the chamber runs and we meet every day. I think the other piece is working with the governor, and we've been in touch. We'll continue to engage, I'm sure, and I'm hoping to help with a small part of the recovery and doing whatever I can within the bounds of the office. You know, I think it's a moment where Vermonters expect and Vermonters want to see, and we'll certainly see from my work that we're able to come together and work together and do a lot of good for our communities and our families and our businesses as we get through this pandemic.
When Phil Scott was Lieutenant Governor, he was invited to be part of Governor Shumlin's cabinet. Have you discussed anything like that with Phil Scott?
We haven't gotten there quite yet, but we have talked, and I know, you know, there's a lot happening right now. I'm sure, as you know, I mean, it's really day to day, and we're going to see a surge in cases over the next 6 weeks. Yeah. So, you know, I'm more focused on how can I be helpful, and working with him and his administration to do whatever needs to be done. But I'm less worried about a seat in the cabinet than I am about just being a thoughtful, effective, and adaptable lieutenant governor to whatever the needs are and what we need to do.
Now, also, when Phil Scott was lieutenant governor, he went around the state with his Vermont Everyday Jobs Tour. Is there anything that you'll be doing to get around the state to get to know the people here and the needs of Vermonters?
Absolutely. You know, one thing I'd like to share, when COVID hit in March, you know, before that, I was down in Bennington on the road every single day. And then we're like, well, what are we going to do? I mean, COVID campaigning is, there's no playbook for that, right?
Right.
But the truth is, we were able to figure out how to use Zoom. And at some point, we're doing, you know, two or three gatherings a night. We did four telephone town halls in April, focused on COVID response and making sure Vermonters had access to information on, you know, food or legal services or mental health and support services. So my focus will be, how do we now use those same tools to meet Vermonters where they're at? Because I think we're in this period of not being able to travel around the state for a while to engage with Vermonters and to meet them, you know, down in Bennington or Brattleboro or up in the Kingdom or in St. Albans, meeting with our business leaders. The focus of my campaign was really on broadband, childcare, and thinking about a classroom to community pipeline to make sure that we can get our graduates from high school and college into the good paying jobs that exist right now in our communities. You know, our businesses, one thing I hear from them time and time again is that recruitment and retention is one of the biggest challenges. So I'll be focusing on those three issues and then looking for ways to stay connected with Vermonters every single day and to bring their voices to Montpelier, even if we're doing that virtually.
And we have a few more minutes with Molly. You can join the conversation at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. And Molly, you're not going to believe it, but our first call for you is from Fred in Newbury. So, Fred, go right ahead.
Morning.
Morning.
Hey, the interesting thing about the minimum wage is, say, Vermont has a a new minimum wage of $15 an hour. I think that would crowd out the marginal worker. And the other interesting thing is, how come Vermont doesn't have a maximum wage?
Both good questions, Fred. Thank you very much. And Molly, go right ahead.
Hi, Fred. Thanks so much for calling in. You know, we've talked a lot about the minimum wage or wages over the last year, and you know, this is a time where we see a lot of folks hoping to get back to work. You know, I can't stress enough, and the governor's been talking about this, but we need COVID relief funds, and we need that funding to come to Vermont as soon as possible. I know our federal delegation, you know, we're so well served by Congressman Welch and Senator Leahy and Senator Sanders. I hope our federal delegation is able to get more COVID relief funding to Vermont. But you know, one thing that I hear from Vermonters, and I think we need to step back and look at, you know, it's not just about the minimum wage or a wage, but how many ways do we ask Vermonters to chop up the paycheck? Mm-hmm. It's childcare. Vermonters pay $20,000 a year on childcare. Student loan debt, which I still have, and every month there's money that goes, you know, I'm not buying a home. I'm still paying off my student loans. Rent, mortgage, heating costs. So I think the bigger question is, how do we address some of those underlying costs and making Vermont a place where families can live and work, and you can also live where you work? You know, we have a huge housing crisis in the state. We did 8 community forums in 17 days in September, and at every forum, housing and the cost of housing came up. So we have a lot to address, but I'm hopeful because from every, you know, challenge comes an opportunity. And I think if we get through this response and move to recovery, we're going to have a lot of opportunities to rethink our priorities and our budget as a state.
And Molly, I'll let you research the maximum wage idea that Fred had, and we'll talk about that in a future interview. I want to go back to the campaign.
Thank you, Fred.
All right.
Yeah, sorry.
I want to go back to that campaign. Early on, I think you held a series of town meeting type events. You overcame a strong Democratic field to get the nomination there. And everyone continues to say you had a really strong ground game, which has proven to be true. So tell us about how you organized your campaign from the outset.
Rick, it sounds like you're asking me to give away our secrets.
A bit, yeah.
Well, I haven't run for office before, and a lot of folks have said, you know, where did Molly Gray come from? Well, you know, I'll be honest, I didn't come from nowhere. I came from Newbury and the University of Vermont and Vermont Law School, and I've lived and worked across the state. But I made a really conscious focus and effort at the beginning to hire Vermonters and group of, I don't want to call them young people, but 20, 30-somethings who love our state, who are really focused on serving their communities. And then we had to kind of throw whatever playbook has been used in the past to run campaigns out the window and kind of create our own. So we focus a lot on relational organizing. So, you know, let's say someone's interested in the campaign and excited about the future of Vermont. They reach out to their network, and their network reaches out to their network. And that's what we did. And we also focus on getting around the state. As I said, you know, we did 8 community forums, socially distant, on town greens, you know, Craftsbury, Richmond, Brattleboro, Bennington, over 17 days, but took a lot of time to meet Vermonters where they're at. And what I now know is you can do that even though there is a pandemic, and there's a lot of tools that can create more access to the political process, but also more access to government. And I think that's a huge lesson learned that I want to carry into the Lieutenant Governor's office, that you shouldn't have to get in the car and drive up to Montpelier to have your voice heard on a, you know, snowy day.
Right.
That we can do that using a lot of the technology that we have. So that's really, really important to me. But, you know, I think you can tell a lot about how someone will lead by how they campaign. And throughout, we made a commitment as a campaign, as a team, to say, we're going to run a positive campaign. We're going to focus on the issues, come what may. And I think Vermonters expect that. And in many ways, this election was kind of a referendum on negative campaigning, which we don't do here in Vermont.
Well, there were definitely rough spots for you during the campaign. Democrats like Senator Ingram, Representative Sullivan endorsed Scott Milne. There were disparaging comments made about you. What were those moments like for you on the campaign trail, especially, you know, the first time out?
Yeah, you know, I hope my brother doesn't mind me sharing this slightly personal story. And if he's listening, he's probably worried. But,
okay.
You know, it was back in the spring. I was home at the farm having dinner, and my brother, you know, brothers are just great, right? They're always giving you advice. And he said, yeah, Molly, you're going to have really thick skin if you're going to do this. And, you know, as a sister, you're always like, oh, of course, I'm going to be fine. But there was one point in the fall, maybe October, where he sent me a text message or called, I can't remember, and he just wanted to know, how are you doing? And that was the moment where I think, you know, it's tough. Campaigning's tough for families. It's tough for loved ones because they see someone they care about really getting scrutinized. But that's what happens when you run for office. And I don't take any of the criticism personally. You know, I think Vermonters need to know that they've got a candidate that can handle it and a lieutenant governor that can handle it. And, you know, I think it's made me stronger. And again, you know, for me, it's really about putting our people, our communities, our families, our workers at the forefront. And I just love this place so much and look forward to serving as lieutenant governor. And not every single day is my focus. And just don't get bogged down in the politics.
We've got another call from Rick in Middlesex. And Rick, thanks for calling Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, thank you. Hey, I got a question for Molly. It's kind of sensitive, and I don't mean to be, you know, demeaning or anything, but during your election, it came out that the voting for in 2016, you were less than genuous about that. And then Rachel Nesbitt went on to put in the same claim about not being quite honest and, well, some other words that I don't need to repeat. But so my question is, how do I, as a Vermonter, really trust you? What can you say that can make me trust you? I mean, I've got to trust you for 2 years because you're in for 2 years. But irregardless of that, what can you say that will make me feel like I could trust you?
All right. Thanks, Rick. That's a good question for Molly. These issues did come up, Molly, and you did address them on the trail, but you will be asked them again. So please feel free to answer, Rick.
Yeah, well, first off, Rick, if it's possible, I'd love to just give you a call and speak to you myself. You know, I think, as I said, I think, you know, family members sometimes, it's really tough. You know, and I can't speak to David Zuckerman or Rachel Nesbitt. You know, obviously, that wasn't a a great moment for anybody, but I don't take it personally. And then I think, you know, on the voting, I've been really clear about that. You know, I made some mistakes when I was younger and wasn't a consistent voter, and that goes for 2016 as well. You know, and I've been forthright about that. But, Rick, I'd be really happy to give you a call, and I look forward to earning your trust every single day and working hard to serve you and focus on the issues and doing all I can to help Vermont recover from this pandemic.
And Rick.
I look forward to having a conversation.
Rick, if you'd like, you can send us your phone number to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com, and I'll be sure to get that to Molly. And you can have that conversation face-to-face. That would be really great. Or and not face-to-face now, but over the phone.
We could set up a Zoom call.
That's
right. I'll call you, Rick.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hey, so when a governor is new, there's a transition team, Molly. What takes place for the lieutenant governor?
Yeah. You know, I think sometimes people think, oh, lieutenant governor's office, there must be, you know, a number of staff. Well, frankly, the lieutenant governor is a pretty small team. It's, you know, the chief of staff. It's a staff of one.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm working right now with outgoing lieutenant governor David Zuckerman and his staffer to prepare for the office. There's a lot of administrative handover. But I'm really focused right now on working with the Secretary of the Senate, John Bloomer, to prepare for the legislative session. As I said, I still plan to go to Montpelier every day and be in the office and be in the chamber presiding from the dais and working with the governor to make sure that we've got a really, really tight team and focusing on the issues and focusing on recovery every single day.
Molly Gray is the Lieutenant Governor-elect of Vermont. I want to thank you and congratulate you for being with us this morning, Molly.
Thank you so much for having me on, and I look forward to coming on again.
Excellent. CBS News is next here on WDEV.
Exciting things are happening in Warren Village. The Pitcher Inn and Warren Store are under new management. Upgrades and improvements are in the works, maintaining the ambiance and character while breathing new energy and resources into these iconic properties. We are open while practicing all CDC protocols. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli and see for yourself what the buzz is all about. Both businesses are hiring, especially seeking fine dining room staff and sales associates for our boutique. Still fun, funky, and friendly, but better than ever. Open daily on Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. COVID case numbers over the last several weeks have been climbing higher and higher, alarming numbers for a state that had been doing so well and was the example for the rest of the country on how to behave and keep control of the spread of the coronavirus. We're going to discuss how things have gotten to this point recently and what we all need to do to get back on track. And joining me to discuss that is Deputy Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan. Tracy, I know this is an extremely trying time for everyone in the health department, so I really appreciate you taking the time to address this with us.
Hi, good morning. It's good to be here. Thanks.
Good. And listeners, if you've got a question for Tracy Dolan, please call now at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Tracy, let's start out and look at what we did right from March through most of October in keeping the pandemic at bay here in Vermont.
Sure. Well, I think one of the things that we did right from a leadership level was that the governor really listened to the public health science from the get-go and took a posture of ensuring that his decisions were data-driven. So early on, we ensured that spacing was happening. We held off on some activities in terms of locking down and shutting down early on. And we got the right messages out. We put a mask mandate in. And Vermonters, for the most part, really got on board with a lot of the important measures like masking, distancing, staying home when sick, washing hands, and all of those things. And so we were fortunate both in terms of leadership and in terms of Vermonters really keeping their contact numbers minimal. All of those things really helped to slow this down and contain it for many months.
And then we really have seen a spike in the numbers. So where have we gone wrong here in the state?
Well, you know, I would not want to frame it so much as going wrong. I think there are some things that we have slipped on, but I do also want to pull back into the context. We have a broader global pandemic happening. We have numbers going up all around us. Even while our numbers stayed low, we saw them creeping up everywhere and surging. And it's almost inevitable that that's going to touch us. You know, we are not an island as much as sometimes we like to think we are. So I think one of the things that went wrong was just numbers rising all around us. But the part that is in our hands is our own behavior. And we certainly did some things wrong there. One of the things we did, and again, wrong is a tricky word because it feels so natural to want to get together with people, but we really started slipping and expanding those social circles, getting together for gatherings, particularly adults getting together in sort of informal gatherings, and the masks would come down and people would be together for longer periods. And because our numbers were low at first, we didn't see the impact of that. And then as the numbers went up all around us and started creeping up here, we saw a very quick impact on that. I mean, we went from, you know, 30 cases a day to 60, 80, 90 within 2 weeks, all the way up to 102 and then 122, a very, very quick doubling and tripling of numbers. And that was about our behaviors here and the numbers around us. And so that's really where we need to pull it back.
At the health department, did you have this sense that there was this COVID fatigue, it was starting to set in, and we were getting lax?
You know, we did. The way we are able to pick up on that, our contact tracers call people to do case investigations and then call up the contacts to advise them. And for the first time, we were starting to get some resistance, people not wanting to pick up the phone because they don't want to hear that they have to go into quarantine, or people picking up the phone but then saying, I'm not going to do that, or I don't want to provide you the list of contacts. And that was really new. I mean, that was a rare thing early on. If somebody did that early on, you know, we had a conference call about it, like, how are we going to manage this? And it was getting more common, and then we realized, okay, people are fatigued, but now we have to double down. Because people were fatigued, they stopped providing the information, but also people started socializing a lot more. And in an environment of rising numbers, that's eventually going to be a powder keg, and what we've got now is a rapid rise that we're really trying to get back under control.
All right. I want to take us back to March. In those early days, we were told things like drink water every 15 minutes, wash your hands often for 20 seconds, sing happy birthday a couple times. So, I mean, let's go through the things we really should be doing again to be diligent about COVID. Lecture us, because we need it again, Tracy.
Sure. The number one thing that you should be doing is limiting social contacts. And so the governor put out an executive order, and he said, do not gather with multiple households. That order is in effect until mid-December. It could go longer depending on what our situation looks like. But particularly coming into the holiday season, holidays are naturally a time when you want to get together with others. So this is going to be a big shift. And so the first most important thing to do is limit your social contacts. If you do that, a lot of the other things don't come into play so much. But when you go out and you are around people outside of your home, mask up, maintain 6 feet, and of course when you're out and about, you want to wash your hands before and after. That continues to be important because we touch things and then we touch our mouths or other openings, and hand washing is also, of course, important for all other infectious disease, including flu. So you want to mask up, of course stay home when sick. Please pick up the phone if you're not sure of the number. It could be the Department of Health contacting you, and please cooperate with our case investigators.
Is hand sanitizer effective in all this?
Hand sanitizer effective, but even more effective is just soap and water. Yeah. I mean, I'm the deputy commissioner, and we don't have hand sanitizer in our house. We use soap and water. I think my kids probably have some hand sanitizer in their backpack for, you know, if they go to school and come back out. But we use hot water and soap, and that works fine as well.
And now we're hearing so much talk about vaccines being so close. So can we relax and just wait for the vaccines?
We can wait for the vaccine, and you can, you know, relax in terms of your mental health. But if relax means do what you want, no, you can't do that kind of relaxing. If anything, you really need to tighten up and be more rigid. Rigid might not be the word that I'm looking for here. More vigilant with your interactions. But once you've made that decision, then you can relax into that. Once you realize, oh, you know what, the decision to call grandma and grandpa and say, we can't go for Thanksgiving, that's the hard conversation. Mm-hmm. But once that's done, You know, then you relax and realize, okay, this is how life's going to be. It's going to be hard for some people. There's no doubt about that. But that's where you can relax. Once you've made those decisions, now you've got your circle, which is your family. And now relax into that, figure out how you're going to stay connected with people, figure out the things you can do. And then hopefully, you know, the vaccine news is fantastic. We did not think we'd be anywhere near a 90 to 95% effectiveness rate. Fauci was talking early on that we would be really fortunate and lucky with a first-time vaccine to have a 50 or 60% effectiveness rate. I mean, 90 to 95, these are the best minds all over the world working on it. And what we've got is an incredible preliminary result.
As far as vaccines, how far along is the state's plan for distributing the vaccine once it arrives?
So we were told to be ready for late November. So we had a plan ready for that. Obviously, that would have been a pretty big rush.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're being told to be ready for the first week of December. Again, probably unlikely that it'll be moving among the general population, but possibly by the end of December, we may even see some dissemination into our first phase, which is really the healthcare workers, because we need to protect that population first. So we're readying for December. You know, that is an ambitious goal from the federal government. We're also very excited, of course, about the plans that we're hearing from President-elect Biden, already putting together a task force. Right now, we have no federal direction whatsoever on COVID response, and so the idea of an administration that's going to have a plan or a policy is very exciting, and we're hoping that really enhances and expedites anything we want to do.
And Tracy, I've never really thought of Halloween in this way before, but it really is the kickoff of the Super Spreader Holiday Parade. So let's start with Halloween and the role it played in this current surge.
Well, it's fascinating. You know, we worked so hard to talk to families of young kids and ask them to change what they were going to do culturally, and it was really successful. You know, you saw all these families with the chutes, putting the candy down the chutes and the distance neighborhood walks, and so we were all sitting thinking how successful that was. And I did not realize, and I think a lot of us did not realize, how many adults like to party on Halloween.
Yep.
I personally felt very left out. I did not get an invitation, but apparently the entire state partied that night, and I did not. And of course, you know, became a huge issue. I think that people think of household small parties as not really a social gathering, not really a big thing, mm-hmm. but Halloween parties absolutely contributed. What really started off a lot of the outbreak activity in Washington County was the ice rink and some of the gatherings related to that, but then that kind of catapulted into some other situations, and what we had was the Halloween parties kicking off new outbreaks and new chains of transmission. So that's really where we looked at the data and we realized, okay, we've really got to shut down this and be very specific and very concrete.
So we have these really family-oriented holidays just ahead. What are you recommending to people now?
We are requiring that people only celebrate with their household, their immediate household. And so if you had planned to get together with another family, with extended family, with grandparents from another home, with people coming in from out of state, the answer now is no. The requirement is single household celebrations. And I know that's very difficult, but keeping in mind, you know, this is hopefully this one holiday season. We shouldn't be seeing this again. The vaccine is coming, but we really need to get vigilant because this virus has shown up again in our long-term care facilities, and we know there that it's much more than a mild illness, as it is among other people as well, mm-hmm. but particularly among the older population, and we really need to be careful there.
And Tracy Dolan, people are probably wondering, I can't have people over for Thanksgiving, but the state is still saying that I can dine out, so why is that acceptable and not this?
Again, the dining out is, again, just with your household, so you're not going to spend time with other people. It's distanced. And we are data-driven. We looked at our data, and there have been no outbreaks or significant transmission that has come from an event at a restaurant in terms of family going to a restaurant. And so we have not found restaurants to be a driver. In the same way, we haven't found schools to be a driver. While there have been cases in schools, there hasn't been significant transmission within a school, because that's another question people are having. Well, if I can't get together with a few people in my home, what about at a school? Mm-hmm. It's really the formal versus the informal. Restaurants have been really good about ensuring that people are doing all the right things. It's when we get into this more informal home environment, it's hard to continue to be vigilant around these things in your own home. And we have seen that time and time again. And so that's why we're trying to put a halt to that, at least temporarily, until we get our numbers back down.
Now, I do remember hearing that as long as the communities around the schools were safe, it was safe to have in-person learning in the schools. Things are starting to surge all around in Vermont. Does that make the schools less safe now to continue with in-person learning?
Right now, we're continuing to keep the schools open. It is possible that if a particular county gets significant community transmission, and that means where it's just transmitting independent of any particular event, but just transmitting continuously in a community, that decision could change. But right now, the schools are not a significant transmission concern. It's really important for kids' mental and social well-being to be at school and around their peers where possible. And schools have been fantastic about masking and spacing, and we have been successful in that approach. And so we're doing everything we can to make sure schools stay open. And one of the things that helps that is keeping your contacts to your household. The more we can slow down this transmission in the community, the more likely the kids will remain safe, and the teachers, of course.
Now, I know one thing that you've done to enlist the help of schools is you're incorporating them into the contact tracing that the health department is doing. So explain how schools are playing a role in the contact tracing now.
So just to be clear, schools are not doing contact tracing. Contact tracing is a very specific process. It involves case investigation, and then it involves skilled health professionals reaching out, or trained professionals reaching out to contacts, interviewing, and providing health advice. So schools are not doing contact tracing. They are doing an initial reach out to let folks know, hey, you might have been a close contact. The Department of Health will be in touch. In the meantime, these are the things you can do. It might be quarantine. It might be, depending on what the advice is. But the schools are simply letting folks know so that they can very quickly take action, while then the Department of Health follows up on the actual contact tracing.
Excellent differentiation, and thank you for correcting me on that. Why did you decide that this was the important way to go, though, to use the schools in that way?
In fact, we actually are using most institutions in that way, including cases themselves. So if I became positive tomorrow, somebody from the health department would likely reach out to me, you know, within 24 hours. They would interview me, and they would tell me, hey, Tracy, think about the people you've been closest to. We'd like you to reach out to them, tell them to quarantine, and we will be in touch. And so I would actually do that right away. And that could happen in a workplace where we might ask a workplace, can you quickly reach out to your staff and let them know to hunker down? We'll be in touch. So we're actually doing that in a variety of environments right now, just to get people aware and to stay at home and lay low while we reach out to them.
And Tracy, this is rarely done, but I am going to turn this show over to you now. It is now the Tracy Dolan Show. I want you to your pitch to Vermonters about staying safe.
Oh, well, I feel like I've been making it the whole time, but I'm happy to make it again. Again, this virus hasn't become any less dangerous or any less transmissible. It is the same virus that we had in March. And so what I really want to tell Vermonters is we really need to tighten up our contacts. We really need to continue to mask up, social distance, wash our hands. If we can get this under control now, it will allow us to continue with the opening we have in our economy, continue to have people at work, and then hopefully continue to open up farther and farther. The more we mess around with these smaller parties, with these kinds of gatherings, the more we tell ourselves, but that's the most important thing, Thanksgiving is the most important thing, the more we are pushing off the reopening, and the more we are possibly harming our economy, let alone our kids' social mental well-being, the elderly people that are in nursing homes who can't have visitors. All of that gets worse when we have more transmission. the answer really, for the most part, lies within us. Not entirely, but there's a great deal of agency we have as human beings right now to modify our behavior and to sacrifice for ourselves, but to sacrifice for others. And as, not to get too patriotic here, but as our governor said, that is really what patriotism is about, when you sacrifice for others. And this is the time to do it, and it's hard, but it won't last forever if we can hunker down and do it now.
That's Tracy Dolan. Thanks so much for that. And this is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Exciting things are happening in Warren Village. The Pitcher Inn and Warren Store are under new management. Upgrades and improvements are in the works, maintaining the ambiance and character while breathing new energy and resources into these iconic properties. We are open while practicing all CDC protocols. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli and see for yourself what the buzz is all about. Both businesses are hiring, especially seeking fine dining room staff and sales associates for our boutique. Still fun, funky, and friendly, but better than ever. Open daily on Main Street, Warren Village.
We're back with Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Okay, earlier I promised you that we'd hear about how you can get money from the state. This is the part of the show where we find all about that. We learn this from State Treasurer Beth Pierce, because it's one of the things that we'll be discussing. It's unclaimed property that the state holds, and they want to get it back to you. That's under Treasurer Pierce's purview. Beth Pierce, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, thank you very much, Rick. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. I hope I'm not making that up. You do want to get this money back to people, right?
Absolutely. We consider this a consumer protection issue, and we really want to get those dollars out to the rightful owner.
That sounds great. Listeners, if you have questions about unclaimed property, you can call us at 244-1777. Toll free, it's 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, Beth Pierce, you do some seriously difficult stuff. I might even say boring work, no offense, as the treasurer. I mean, pensions. I think you and David Coates and I are the only people who really dig chatting about pensions. But this unclaimed property, this has got to be great fun for you to try to get it back to people.
It really is. And, you know, we do have a number of different divisions and work that we do in the treasurer's office, pension administration being one of them, and working with our pension investment committee on investing those dollars. Also to treasury operations, we pay the bills for the state, or disperse the dollars, I should say. But this one is really a lot of fun. We really see this, as I said, as a consumer protection issue. You know, unclaimed property, let me define what that is first. It's financial assets or accounts within financial institutions or companies, or perhaps a security deposit that you forgot about, or a deposit for utilities. And these typically have had no action activity for several years, and the business is required to try to find the owner first. And if they're unable to do so, to remit those to the state, and we safeguard that property, and we work to find the owner or the heir of properties. We refer to this as the rightful owner, and get those dollars back to them. So we have a number of outreach programs to try to find those individuals, and I appreciate the opportunity today to talk about that. And hopefully, as folks are listening, they will contact our office to see if we have property for them. And you can do that two ways. You can call our toll-free number, so 1-800-642-3191, or check out our website at missingmoney.vermont.gov. We'd love to get those dollars back to you.
So when you get this turned over by someone, what kind of information comes with it? How voluminous is the information you have about who it actually belongs to?
So we refer to the companies and the institutions that have those dollars as holders. Mm-hmm. And they hold those dollars, and they're required to remit those to us, I believe on May 1st is the required. But we do receive them at different points in the year. November, we do receive a significant amount of dollars, because some states have that as their deadline. But they will send over the information that they have. So they may not have an updated address, for instance, or they have in their files some information about the original owner, but not necessarily the heirs. So they will send over what they do have, and then we will try to do some research and supplement that information, try to take a look through our databases at, for new addresses, and reach out to those individuals. We go through a process of sending out letters to folks that we think that may have unclaimed property, and invite them to call our office. We do ads. As I said, we do shows like this to try to get that information out, and we're very grateful for that opportunity. So the information will vary, and some of that information, for instance, if it's a life insurance policy, we will have additional information on the policy, when it might have been first purchased, and some of that information in the data files that they send to us. So it will vary. If it's a traveler's check, it's going to have different information behind it rather than a life insurance policy or a certificate of deposit. We do collect mostly what I would call tangible financial assets. The one exception are safe deposit boxes. Those are remitted to us, and they might have money. They might have various financial assets, for instance, stock holdings. They also have materials that are very personal to folks. Family history, pictures. We get some interesting things in those safety deposit boxes. So we're going to have different types of information. We do what we can to update that information and get out and talk to those individuals and get those monies back to people.
This idea of returning the unclaimed property, is this a Vermont thing because we're so kind and caring and giving here?
Well, I would say, yes, we are kind and caring and giving, number one, and I think that's one of the things that makes Vermont special. That said, every state has some form of unclaimed property office, whether in the treasurer's office, some in the revenue departments. I think we do a great job of some historical data. We haven't had more recent, is that we're in the top five in the country in terms of the amount of money we receive. And the amount of money, the percentage that's subsequently returned to individuals. Mm. And I'm very, very proud of that. And we're going to continue to improve on that record and continue to find new ways. New technologies are there, and we use those technologies to try to reach out to folks. So I think we're one of the top folks in the country in doing this. All states have this type of relationship, unclaimed property funds, but I'll go as far to say we're one of the best.
How much is the state holding on to right now?
Well, that's a really good question. We have roughly $99.9 million in assets belonging to various people. We have 76,000 different records of money on hand. So we want to get that back to you, and some of these are very, very old folks that have not claimed them over a long period of time, and we may have less information on some of those old accounts, but as we've moved forward, we've improved the holder reporting and our additional research to guide us in getting those dollars out the door.
Just pennies shy of $100 million would make a great rainy day fund. Beth Pierce, is there ever a point where that defaults to state coffers?
Well, a portion of it is remitted to the general fund each year, and it's based on a formula that's in statute. So it is being used providing for those resources. On the other hand, none of those monies are permanently transferred. An individual always has the right to claim their rightful funds.
How long has this been going on in Vermont?
Well, I believe the first act, Unclaimed Property Act, nationally was around 1954, and someplace shortly after that, I believe Vermont adopted it. We've had different versions of the Unclaimed Property Act over the years, updating our statutes. About 3 years ago, actually a little longer than that, in 2016, there was a change and revision to the National Unclaimed Property Revision Act. So it was a model act that states could use. I happen to be one of the two state advisors to the Uniform Law Commission that developed this act, and with a great deal of effort, but we are thrilled to be a part of that. Vermont has now adopted that model with some revisions unique to Vermont, particularly around life insurance policies. And, you know, so we're continuing to revise. Technologies have changed over the years. The last version prior to 2016 was, I believe, 1996. And I would suggest that banking has changed since 1996. Financial institutions have changed. Technologies have changed. So this was a great opportunity to update the act and to make it more consumer friendly.
Before we go to break, Beth Pierce, please let people know again that phone number and website that they can go to learn about this unclaimed property.
Great. So we want, again, that number is 1-800-642-3191. And you can check out our website at, let me get to that. Excuse me for just a moment.
Okay.
missingmoney.vermont.gov. So missingmoney, one word, no space, .vermont.gov.
And Beth Pierce, about how much do you get back to the rightful owners each year?
Well, it will vary from year to year. This past year was about $4.7 million. It was as much as $6.4 some years.
Mm-hmm.
It'll vary from year to year, someplace between, I'd say, $4 to $7 or $8 million.
If someone has just a small amount that's owed to them and they just want to pay it forward to the state, can they do that as well?
Well, we do have a process. As I mentioned earlier, there is a formula in statute for monies to go to the general fund. But again, you never lose your opportunity to claim those dollars. But they're used for the benefit of the state in the meantime. We also have a program, and that came from just the question you asked. Folks would ask at our fairs, for instance, when we would have a booth on unclaimed property, they'd say, I just want it to go to charity. So we have a process that says that if it's over 10 years of, old since we received the property, and I believe it's under $100, that will go to the higher education trust fund. So that could be used for scholarships for Vermont students. And
oh,
so that is an opportunity we do have. And again, since we've done that, we've probably had half a dozen folks come in and say that they wanted to claim their property. So that would be up to $600, and we sent over millions to the trust fund for higher education. But again, you never lose the opportunity to claim those funds.
All right, let's talk about another favorite subject of yours, debentures and fiduciary trusts. Joking. Financial literacy. That's what we're going to talk about. Why is financial literacy something you're very passionate about?
Well, financial literacy, people ask first, what does that mean? And for me, financial literacy means the ability to use knowledge and skills to manage financial resources for a lifetime of financial well-being. And I think that last part, a lifetime of financial well-being, is the critical part of this that definition. We in the Treasurer's Office, that overriding goal in all the programs we have, whether it's working with taxpayer dollars in terms of our investments, whether it is our retirement administration for folks that are contemplating retirement, our bottom line is that we want everyone in this state, every single person, to have a lifetime of financial well-being. You know, I always say that you want it for yourself, you want it for your family. We want it for every single person in Vermont. And so we have a number of programs in financial literacy included to try to promote that. Now, we have a very small staff, so we have a financial literacy director and other folks who assist in different projects. So we're not going to go out there and have a multitude of programs requiring multiple staff. So what we do is work through a three-pronged approach. One is advocacy to promote financial literacy and raise awareness. And again, thank you for that opportunity. We also collaborate. So collaboration with state, local, national groups to support and participate in financial literacy initiatives. I was co-chair of a financial literacy commission with folks from John Pelletier from Champlain College. And we have development. Where there is a gap, we build new programs and work to put those out for various folks. We had a program. We have a program called Reading is an Investment. And in that program, we have a two-pronged approach there. You know, you're hoping to have children, so it's kindergarten through grade six, I believe. And it encourages reading, which we think is very important, and encouraging young children to develop good skills. Now, when you're in the kindergarten, you probably don't want to read a book about 401ks or something along that line. So it might be the bunny that saves versus the bunny that didn't. But we try to get those concepts out to folks. By the way, if you have a child that can read and wants to read about 401ks or financial instruments in kindergarten, let me know. We'd be willing to have an interview with them when they get a little older. But it's a great program. Over 5,000 kids have completed the program each year. We estimate about 12,000 participate in the program at one level or another. It's a great program. From that, we said, let's expand this and see if there are other ways we can reach out to children. And we now have a work in terms of collaboration with the after-school programs. It's a model program a year or two ago, and now we've pretty much doubled that operation. So we're working with the after-school programs on curriculum for financial literacy and reaching out to those children. We have seminars and programs for folks in their golden years. I'm probably a little closer to that. And so we have programs there. In the past, we had a program that when a number of our service people were going overseas to work with families on what they should think about in terms of financial literacy at that point and helping them with managing through a very tough time. So we try to look for opportunities and where gaps exist. We work with various foundations. All of our unclaimed property programs are funded through grants from a variety of sources, not taxpayer dollars. We do have one position in the office that is funded through our appropriations. But the programs themselves have various partners, the Vermont Student Assistance Corporation, the Vermont Bankers Association, a number of different trust funds. So it's a great partnership with the community as well.
Beth, what are some basic concepts that people should understand about finances?
Well, we always have a little motto that says pay yourself first. Folks are not inclined to save a lot of dollars, especially that baby boomer population, and a lot of those folks are now retiring, and they have very little money to meet their needs. And, you know, that's a concern that we have. People aren't saving enough money for retirement. A number of folks, a very high percentage, rely just on Social Security. And the average monthly benefit in this state for Social Security, based on a 2018 study, was $1,419 per month. That's just a tad over $17,000 a year. Mm-hmm. And that is below the 2018 Vermont livable wage level. So you need to have additional savings. We want to help folks find opportunities to do that. We recently created something called the Green Mountain Secure Retirement Plan because we found that over 100,000 people, this was based on an AARP study, did not have access to employer-sponsored retirement plans. So we worked with our partners, again, the banking, the insurance industries, different groups of types of businesses, and we created a retirement program for small businesses, so businesses under 50 and their for their employees. And small businesses, as you know, are the backbone of our economy. And we're just rolling this program out now. We've got a few more processes as we're moving forward, and we're going to test this with some companies. But we think that this is a great opportunity to help with saving for the future, saving for those golden years, and helping individuals have adequate income in retirement. Now, when you look at that, that's also a good thing for the state, because when people have adequate income, they buy goods and services, so they're an economic generator. So I look at this as a win-win proposition. You know, it's good for the individual, it's good for the state's economy, and we love those win-win propositions.
All right, another win-win is this whole idea of unclaimed property. I want to double back on that to make sure that people understand that. Again, explain kind of briefly what unclaimed property is and then tell people how they can claim it.
Sure. So unclaimed property are financial property that or financial assets that have been with financial institutions or companies that have now been remitted because there's been no activity, and they've been remitted to us so we can safeguard those assets and then reach out to individuals to return that money to the rightful owner. Everything from saving and checking accounts to utility deposits, life insurance, uncashed dividends. And you can find out about that property, see if you have property, by contacting our office. And you can do that by calling 1-800-642-3191 or check out our website at missingmoney.vermont.gov. And there's a tool there to research, you know, for yourself. And hopefully some of your relatives have some money in there as well. We encourage you to take a look at that. Also on our website, life insurance is a project that we've worked on for a number of years, making sure that people get those dollars when they perhaps are unaware that there was an insurance policy that was taken out by a relative, for instance. And there are tools listed on that website. Number one, they're all in that same website, missingmoney.vermont.gov, but also some tools getting back to financial literacy so individuals can start to do some planning about making sure that their loved ones have opportunity to get those dollars in a timely manner when they need them the most.
And I do want to point out that you just never know where that money might be coming from when it's this unclaimed property. It was like an online farmer's market type thing that was set in Chittenden County, and you had to put in a certain amount each time. And after I stopped using it, there was just a few dollars left. And sure enough, that was what my unclaimed property was with the state of Vermont. So you just never know. Beth, tell people again how they can find out if they have any unclaimed property with the state.
Sure. So that number is 1-800-642-3191. Or you can check our website at missingmoney.vermont.gov.
And there's $100 million sitting there, so it might be yours. Not all of it, but some of it. Beth Peer is Vermont State Treasurer. She's just won re-election. So, Beth, congratulations, and thanks for being on with us this morning.
My pleasure, and hopefully from this this show that we will see some uptick in our numbers. We encourage people to give us a call. And again, thank you for the opportunity to do outreach through this program.
By tomorrow, it's going to be down to $60 million, I guarantee it.
Okay. Thanks. We would love to hear that. Okay.
Thanks,
Beth.
Thank you. CBS News Update is next. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Exciting things are happening in Warren Village. The Pitcher Inn and Warren Store are under new management. Upgrades and improvements are in the works, maintaining the ambiance and character while breathing new energy and resources into these iconic properties. We are open while practicing all CDC protocols. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli and see for yourself what the buzz is all about. Both businesses are hiring, especially seeking fine dining room staff and sales associates for our boutique. Still fun, funky, and friendly, but better than ever. Open daily on Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. This summer, the legislature overrode Governor Phil Scott's veto of the Global Warming Solutions Act. H-688 requires the state to reduce greenhouse gas pollution. So now what happens? Here to give us an idea of what the legislature has indeed wrought is 7 Days State House reporter Kevin McCollum. And Kevin, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
Listeners, if you have questions about what will happen in the wake of the override of this bill, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Kevin, give us some basic highlights of this Global Warming Solutions Act.
Okay, so as many of your listeners will probably recall, this was one of the highest profile bills that the legislature passed this last session, and it did so over the, as you noted, objections of Governor Scott, who vetoed it. But the lawmakers were able to muster enough votes to override that veto, and so it became law. And the Global Warming Solutions Act was designed to effectively force Vermont to meet its greenhouse gas emissions goals. As many people probably remember, you know, the state has been a leader in saying that it wanted to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions because of climate change and all the concerns about that that everyone is well aware of. But there was a lot of criticism, has been a lot of criticism, that the state has not been meeting those goals or is not on track to meet those goals. So lawmakers said, you know, this isn't working. We're not having a goal is not good enough. We have to hold the state accountable for its promises, for its pledges, for its plans to reduce these emissions. So let's make them mandatory. Let's make the parameters which call for reduced emissions by certain amounts by certain years. Let's make those law. Let's make those something that the state has to do. And so the Global Warming Solutions Act did that. And now, starting Friday, a 23-member panel called the Vermont Climate Council is going to begin meeting, try to figure out a roadmap for how to get there.
Why was this so important to the Democrats and the progressives in the legislature, so important that they overrode Governor Scott's veto of it?
Well, if you recall, I mean, there were teenagers and 20-somethings and young people marching in the streets, you know, before COVID hit. Climate change was really the number one issue on the minds of many people in the state and indeed the nation. So this was something that there had been tremendous political pressure brought to bear on Democrats and Republicans and everyone and to do something about this. And so I think the Democrats felt that and not just the Democrats, but independents and progressives all came together and effectively said, we have to do this. We have to show our citizens, the citizens of Vermont, that we're serious about getting this done. And so there was very, very strong support for this bill. And there was very, very strong opposition from the administration and from many Republicans who argued that this was a good idea. The intent was right, but it was the wrong way to go about it.
What were those objections?
Effectively, Governor Scott and people who agreed with him felt as though setting up this panel, setting up a 23-member panel, was not going to get the job done. that having a bunch of experts sit around and come up with a plan over the course of a year, they have a year to deliver this thing, that was kind of taking the responsibility for doing the work out of the hands of the legislature, out of the hands of the administration, and putting it into an independent or quasi-independent body. And Governor Scott just felt that was muddled, right? That was confusing. It was like, well, who's responsible for really meeting these goals? Is it the administration, the Agency of Natural Resources, or is it the legislature and the lawmakers whose job it is to, you know, spend money on initiatives that might actually make progress toward these goals? So he just felt it was not the right way to go. Many Republicans agreed with him on that, and he went so far as to say that he thought it was just a flat-out unconstitutional panel, unconstitutional approach to this issue. So that's why we thought focusing on what this panel is and how it's going to work was interesting, given that it had done such fierce opposition.
Who is on this Vermont Climate Council?
It's a long list. I don't think you want me to read the whole thing. But
no, I don't.
23, there's 23 folks. There are 8 members of the administration, many of whom are pretty much the heavy hitters in Governor Scott's administration. You've got people like Secretary Julie Moore, who's you know, the head of the Agency of Natural Resources, and you know, she's obviously one of the leaders in the environmental regulation arena in the state of Vermont. It's being chaired by Suzanne Young, she's director of administration for the state. And then there are a number of members of the council who've been appointed by the legislature. So it was a mix, right? It was administration officials plus people who were put on by the legislature. And some of the people who were put on by the legislature include some real environmental advocates and well-regarded environmental advocates who've been doing this for a long, long time, thinking long and hard about how the state ought to go about reducing its emissions. You've got people like Rich Cowart, who was head of the Public Utility Commission for years, and you've got people like Chair Duvall, who is head of the Energy Action Network. That was it's kind of this organization that sort of tracks the state's progress on how it's meeting those goals. And you've got a hodgepodge of people from various sectors, like the dairy industry. You've got a youth member, people on from renewable energy companies. So it's a real interesting mix of folks, and I spoke to several of them.
The eight members who are from the Governor Scott administration, what have you heard from them? Are they fighting this? Are they coming along willingly? Will they be at constant loggerheads with the rest of the committee?
Well, that's certainly what people are worried about, right? I spoke to Suzanne Young about this at length, and she insisted that, you know, even though she and other members of the administration have these concerns about how the panel is, you know, organized and constructed, they're going to go into it with the right attitude, and they're going to work really hard to try to come up with a plan that gets the job done and shows how the state can hit these goals. I think the concern is twofold. One is that the criticism of the panel and how it's constructed is may effectively undermine some of that work. And B, that Governor Scott formed a climate council 3 years ago it was called the Climate Commission 3 years ago that was something he formed with 21 people on it that came up with 53 different recommendations about things that should be done. And many people were very disappointed that many of those recommendations were not followed. I think it's twofold. This panel has been criticized for how it's constructed, and Governor Scott had a panel, a very similar one, just a couple of years ago that some would argue was ineffective. Others think it actually did really work and that it informed a lot of the policies that it has pursued, but that's just sort of that's debatable.
Kevin, what are the logistics of how this committee will operate and how often they'll meet?
Those are all things that are going to be sorted out in the coming days. The first meeting is on Friday. When I spoke to some of the administration officials, that they hadn't actually worked out all those details yet. But clearly it's going to meet as a panel, maybe quarterly, maybe monthly, and then it'll break up into subcommittees that will do some of the heavy lifting. It'll be groups that will bore in and focus very closely on certain aspects of the plan and then try to come together in these larger meetings and have more discussions among all of the parties.
Do we have any idea what this committee will cost taxpayers?
I have seen some figures. It is in the several hundred thousand dollar range, as I recall, because all of the members are expected to get, you know, paid for their work, and it is meant to last a year. I don't have that figure exactly handy, and I don't think the exact figure is known yet. There was a substantial amount of money that the legislature set aside to make sure that the panel could do its work. I know that there was, I think the biggest piece was that the Agency of Natural Resources had asked for several positions to be created because they felt as though the panel was going to require a great deal of research and analysis to do its work, and that they were going to need some extra bodies to help pull that off. So I don't think those folks have been hired yet, but they've been budgeted, and I think they probably will be hired in the coming months.
They have a year to develop a plan. When that happens and they create their recommendations, what then? Will it have any teeth, or will it be like Governor Scott's Climate Action Commission?
Yeah. So the whole point of this is to create a law that has some teeth. And how that actually works is yet to be determined. But the law, the teeth that the law has in it is that it's twofold. One is that if the measures that the administration and the state take to try to conform with the plan and the roadmap, if they don't do enough of them, and if the indications are that the emissions are not dropping enough to meet the goals, then a citizen, a regular citizen, can go to court and say, hey, judge, you know, the state is not following its own laws. The state is not doing enough to reduce emissions. So we think you should order it to do something more stringent. And that, I think, is the provision that many of the opponents are most scared about. They really feel as though allowing a judge at some point in the future to basically order the state to take more draconian or drastic measures to reduce emissions is a bad idea, because it ties the state's hands. And that it limits the types of remedies that a judge might order, right? That's basically what people are concerned about. That yes, it has teeth, but some people are worried about getting bitten too.
Well, the goals of the Global Warming Solutions Act are to reduce greenhouse gas pollution to 26% below 2005 levels by 2025, and then emissions would need to be 40% below 1990 levels by 2030, and 80% below by 2050. The commission that Governor Scott had developed back in 2017, what they proposed, would they have come close to any of those goals?
I think, and now you're going to catch me without knowing for sure.
That's okay.
I believe that the way that the last report was structured was that there was a whole host of suggestions for things that could be done. And if many of them, or a significant number of them were followed, that report did conclude that the state could meet these goals. Not only that, but I think the report noted and stressed that if the state made some of those transitions, that it actually would be a huge economic boon to the state. I'm sure you know, people are scared that sort of this is going to be a drain on the economy.
Right.
This is going to be it's going to cause gas prices to increase. It's going to create these restrictions that are just, you know, that people aren't going to appreciate or that will be costly. And so, but what that report showed, I think, was that if we do a more forceful switch to, you know, renewable energy sources, to electric vehicles, to electric heat pumps in people's homes, if we get off of fossil fuels and onto more electric sources of energy, right? Because electricity in the state of Vermont is pretty clean. A lot of it comes already from solar and wind and from hydro. That if we use more electricity instead of more gas and fuel oil to drive our cars and heat our homes, that our emissions will dramatically drop. So that report made such recommendations and concluded that we could hit these targets. It's just that doing so was going to be pricey, right? It was going to be difficult, and it was going to mean significant change for people's lives. I mean, changing the kind of car you drive, or swapping out your furnace for a pellet stove, or for an electric heat pump, and they can be expensive propositions. And so that's caused people to be concerned. And I think a lot of people still are.
Was it the price of those recommendations that was the cause for that committee's recommendations not gaining traction?
Well, I think, sure, yeah. No, if you're Governor Scott and you're looking at this list of 53 things that you ought to do, the cost of those initiatives is definitely on your mind as you're looking at a state budget that's perennially got challenges in every quarter, right? How do we pay for schools? How do we pay for unemployment? How do we pay for everything else? And I think it's a very difficult proposition to take tens of millions of dollars of state funds and plow them into programs that will reduce our carbon emissions, when that takes some foresight and some forethought and some long-range thinking, right? Whereas a lot of voters, the people in the state, are kind of living day-to-day and focused on their household budgets, and they're more focused on those things than the long-term. But I think that is changing. I think people are, more and more people are recognizing that the state is going to have to do more to meet its goals. Otherwise, it won't do what it said it was going to do, which was, you know, stay in the climate, the Paris Climate Accord. As you probably remember, mm-hmm. Governor Scott, you know, said that the state of Vermont would remain in the Paris Climate Accord when President Trump said we were done with that as a nation. He said, well, Vermont's not done with that. We're going to keep plowing forward and hit that mark. Well, that mark is getting closer and closer. That's only 2025. That's not that far away. And so that was one of the other reasons I thought this story was interesting, is because we have a president who's now saying that the U.S. is going to come back in the Paris Climate Accord. And so I figured it'd be a good time to check in to see how the state's doing.
Absolutely. And you mentioned Vermont voters. They did not sweep the Democrats and progressives out, although Republicans did make some modest gains in the House and Senate. So does this show that there is definitely support from Vermonters for this act and this commission?
Well, that's a good question, isn't it? You know, I think there was more than 100 votes in favor of the override. It was 106 or something votes in favor of overriding the governor's veto. But you're right. There was an election just not long ago that showed Republicans making modest gains in the state. So you do have to ask yourself, well, what does that mean? Did people feel that they were worried that the Global Warming Solutions Act was a bad idea, and did that lead to some Republican gains? Are they worried about, you know, their gas prices going up, if there's some kind of carbon tax or some sort of, you know, measure around the corner that's going to impact their lives? So that's a good question, and we're going to continue to try to do some more reporting to find out if that's the case.
Excellent. Kevin McCallum is the State House reporter for 7 Days. I want to thank you for joining us this morning. And the new edition of 7 Days is out throughout the state of Vermont today, so you can find Kevin McCallum's reporting there. Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks, Rick.
And that's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Taylor Dobbs and directed by Peter Cormier. I'm Rick Singeri, and I'll meet you back here tomorrow.